All right, now joining me is one of the great musicians of this or any other time, and that's John Oates. Let me give you some background on John. He's from New York City, but spent a large portion of his life in North Wales, Pennsylvania, which is just a little north of Philadelphia. He attended Temple University, where he and Daryl Hall met, would become college roommates. They were a part of several different college bands before joining forces and becoming one of the most successful duos in pop rock history. They've sold over 80 million records worldwide. In 2017, John published his memoirs titled Change of Seasons, which is an Amazon bestseller. He's recorded 8 solo albums, including his most recent titled Arkansas, John Oates with the Good Roads Band, which is a little Dixieland, a little bluegrass, a little Delta blues. He now lives in Woody Creek, Colorado, as well as in Nashville, Tennessee. I understand he's a Tennessee Titans fan, which we're definitely going to get into. And I'm very honored he's with me here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, John, Chris Mascaro, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, Chris, it's great to be on with you, man.
So, John, we'll certainly get into all the music things here in a minute, but like I said there at the end, I hear you live in Nashville, now heard you're a Tennessee Titans fan. So how excited are you about the AFC Championship game this weekend?
Well, I can tell you what, Music City is pumped. There is no doubt about it. It's cool. And, you know, Nashville's become a pretty amazing sports town, you know, with the Preds. I mean, the Predators are just fan favorites, and people go absolutely nuts over the hockey. And now the Titans have given the Nashville folks something to get very excited about. So can't wait till Sunday, man. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, no doubt. So tell me about your fandom with the Titans. Is it always been a thing? Do you go back as far as the 99 Super Bowl, or is that something you've adopted recently?
Well, the thing is, I moved to Nashville in the early 2000s. So I've been living here a little bit, about 10 years. And so, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it's funny. I've lived when I look back at my life, I've kind of lived for about 20 years in every place. I lived 20 years in Pennsylvania. And, you know, but my parents came from New York. My dad was a Giants fan. And so he always, there was always a special kind of affinity for the Giants when I was growing up. And then, of course, it was the Eagles. And then I moved to Colorado for 20 years, and I got to be a real Denver Broncos fan, especially during their heyday. And it was very cool. I got to meet a lot of the guys on the Broncos, and in those days, I used to go to the games. And then now moving to Nashville, you know, you just kind of adopt the local color, man. And Nashville is, as I said, it's a great sports town and obviously a great music town. And now the Titans got it going on, and we'll see what happens on Sunday.
So are you there? Are you going to Titans games? Are you going to go to the championship game?
Oh, I've been to a few home games. No, I'm not going out to Kansas City, though. I'm actually working this weekend. I'm gonna make sure I get enough time to squeeze in to see the game. Luckily, I'll be able to see it because I'm working Sunday night. But Sunday afternoon, my butt will be firmly implanted on the couch.
That's awesome. So, John, let's talk about some of your music. And I've always sort of been curious when we're nearing the process of writing a song. How do you know when it's right? How do you know when, you know, you've heard it and you go, you know what? Yeah, that's it.
It's funny. You know, someone asked, we just had that discussion just recently with another young songwriter. You know, like when do you stop? You know, when do you got it right? Well, I can tell you about the initial thing is that when I'm writing and I'm in especially in a collaboration when you're working with somebody, sometimes I'll get like literally get goosebumps on my arms and I kind of get this feeling. It's hard to describe. It's something that you really can't describe, but I know what it is. And I sense that, okay, something's happening here. Something right is happening. And then, you know, a lot of times after that, it's more like, okay, we got that. You know, we got the divine inspiration just happened, but now it gets down to the hard work, the craftsmanship of it, you know, really honing it and tweaking it and rewriting and making sure that all the loose ends are tied up, you know, musically and lyrically. So it really can be, like this process that's totally spontaneous, and it just seems to be like a gift from the gods. And then it can be like, you know, like kind of rolling up your sleeves and going to work. So it's really, it could be either of those things.
John, as I was kind of going through your memoirs, going through your book, you tell a very interesting story behind the song She's Gone about a chance meeting with a girl at a diner in the very early morning hours, and it turned into that song. Do you mind sharing that story?
Sure. And it's all true, too. Well, you know, it was New York. I had just, well, you know, Daryl and I had moved to New York in 71 or 72. And so we made one album called Whole Oats, and it didn't do much, but it was kind of getting our feet wet. And we were about to make our second album, which ended up being called Abandoned Luncheonette. And, you know, I used to hang around downtown in Greenwich Village. You know, I was always hitting the clubs and the music venues and things, just checking out what was going on. And it was a really late night. It was about 2-3 in the morning, and went into this, it was a soul food restaurant, called the Pink Teacup. It was on Bleecker Street. And, went in there, and this gal came in, and she was just dressed. It was dead of winter. It was freezing cold. And she, you know, she had a pink tutu and cowboy boots on. And I thought, okay, this, something's going on here. And, we just hit it off. And so I figured, well, I'll just see what she's doing on New Year's Eve. And when New Year's Eve came, she was supposed to come over to the place, the apartment. And I was sitting there waiting for her. She never showed up. I had my guitar, and I said, well, I guess she's gone. She ain't coming back. And I started strumming on my guitar and just singing this little thing. And I played it for Daryl. He said, man, that's cool. Let's work that up. And he and I got together. We wrote it. We wrote that song in probably an hour and a half. Really everything.
Wow.
Like totally, it just happened. And you know, it's one of those songs that to this day we play it every night and people love it. And it sounds absolutely as contemporary today as it sounded back in 73.
John, when I think about the music industry, it's certainly not the easiest thing to get into. Certainly not the kindest thing to people along the way, even for a duo when you guys were at the very top doing the research. There was a time when you guys had no privacy, people chasing you everywhere you went. And then in the mid 80s, when you guys were on top, you and Daryl just stopped. It just ended for a while. Talk about that time. Was it all the craziness surrounding you guys and the sort of a loss of a private life that kind of drive you guys to take a look at one another and say, you know what, we need some time apart here?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much that he and I needed time apart from each other. We needed time apart from the music business. We both felt the same way. It wasn't like a personal thing between me and Daryl. It was more like a personal thing between me and Daryl and the music business. We spent 10 years creating, you know, developing our sound and our career through the 70s. And so by the 80s, when we had all these giant pop hits, and, you know, it's hard to put it into perspective, you know, but it's hard to imagine what was going on. But we had won numerous awards, American Music Awards and all this. We had done We Are the World with Michael Jackson. We did we headlined Live Aid, you know, headlined the show in Philadelphia with Mick Jagger and Tina Turner. We did Live at the Apollo with our childhood heroes, Eddie Kendrick and David Ruffin from The Temptations. And this all happened within 6 months. It was kind of the most intense thing you can imagine. And then we were at the top of the mountain, and we had number one hit after number one hit, sold millions of records, with constantly traveling around the world. And we said, hey, man, there's only one way for us to go at this point, and that's down. And we just didn't want to do that. We didn't want to chase success. We had success. We were happy. We knew what we had. We knew what we achieved a lot. And we thought, if we're going to keep doing this for the rest of our lives, we've got to figure this thing out, because we'll just burn out and become like, you know, we'll become, you know, just another name on a list of Billboard top 100 people who you never hear of again. And we had no intentions of doing that. And I think it was a smart move. It wasn't the smartest thing commercially, because, you know, obviously the record company and everybody wanted us to keep churning out the hits. But for us personally, it was probably the best thing we ever did, because I left New York. I moved to Colorado, started a family, built a house, had a kid, did all the things I couldn't do or hadn't done. And it changed my life. And now I'm still, I mean, as crazy as it seems, Daryl and I are now bigger than we were back in those days. You know, we just sold out Madison Square Garden in like a week. We're playing giant venues all over the world, and people still love our music. So I guess if you look back, we made the right decision.
And John, when I was reviewing the Behind the Music special that VH1 did with you guys, there's a scene where it said that Brandon Flowers from The Killers says, everything you need to know about writing the perfect song is in Rich Girl. What about that song is a blueprint for a great song?
Well, first of all, I didn't write it. Daryl wrote that. And I would agree with Brandon Flowers. It's pretty much a perfect pop song. It's got this kind of like a very interesting introduction, you know, where it's like kind of slow and you know, there's no instrumentation. It's just Daryl on a piano, and all of a sudden it kicks in. It's got an amazing groove. It's tight. It says exactly what it needs to say in a very succinct way. I guess that's pretty much a good definition for a pop song.
In 2003, you and Daryl put out an album titled Do It For Love. What inspired the title and that song?
Well, you know, we hadn't recorded, let's see, we only recorded one album really in the 90s. 96, we recorded an album called Marigold Sky. And it was a really cool record. It wasn't that commercially successful, but it kind of, you know, it was fun to do and it was just something for us to kind of keep our, you know, our kind of name in the game. But in 2000, we felt like, you know, man, you know, it's probably time for us to make a record. And, Daryl was living in England. He had found some folks who he liked working with, some production people. And so we went over, recorded some stuff in England. And, actually, I wasn't as involved in the record at first. And then when I decided to go over to England, I was like thinking to myself, man, I don't know what, I don't have much to bring to the table. You know, I don't know what's going on. And as I, it was the first day I got there and I was walking across this bridge to the studio, on the other side of the river. And, I was thinking to myself, why am I doing this? I was actually saying to myself, you know, what the hell am I doing? I'm in London, you know, I don't know if I really want to be here. You know, why am I doing this? And I thought, well, I must be doing it for love. There must be a reason. It must be the love of the music. And I walked in the studio that day and I said, hey, man, I said, I got an idea. I said, I'm, you know, why are we doing this, man? We must be doing it for love because we don't need to do it for any other reason. And everybody went, yeah, that's cool. Let's do it. And we wrote that song and it became the title song of the album.
You know, in that VH1 special, you say that you always felt like you had more to offer than all the pop songs that you guys were known for. What was burning in you that you got to end up sharing and doing the title song, Thousand Miles of Life, that you put together with Jeff Berg?
Well, you know, I've collaborated with a lot of people over the years. And living in Nashville, and, you know, you get to collaborate with some of the great musicians and greatest songwriters in the world. It's always an interesting thing to collaborate because it's magic that happens between two personalities, two kind of points of view. And you know, you really... Being a songwriter is a pretty cool thing because you make something from nothing. You know, you kind of just pluck some emotion out of the air and you formulate it into something that people can relate to. So, you know, my Nashville experience, Thousand Miles of Life, was really a chance for me to kind of go back in my musical past to the stuff that I was doing before I met Daryl. And it was much more bluesy and rootsy and much more folk and folk blues oriented. And so that's what I've done in my solo career. I've kind of leaned on this kind of ability to tap back into my original musical inspiration. And so my stuff is much more earthy and much more raw than the stuff that I've done with Daryl.
One of my favorite songs, John, on that CD is The Good Son. What's the story behind that song?
Well, here again, another interesting collaboration with a very interesting person. That was co-written by myself and a guy named Jed Lieber. Jed Lieber is the son of Jerry Lieber from the, you know, the legendary songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller, who wrote Hound Dog and Up on the Roof and, you know, Jailhouse Rock, a million great, great classic rock songs. Jed and I worked together for quite some time. And, Jed, you know, was one of those guys who, you know, he's the son of a famous songwriter and a famous musician. I think sometimes it's hard to live in the shadow of a famous father. And I know that maybe from my son. You know, my son's 23. Luckily, he's not a musician, and I'm really happy about that. But I think living in the shadow of a famous father, you know, it's got its positive and negative. And that's something that we, Jed and I, were just talking about on a personal level, you know. And as I got to know him, I realized, you know, there's a lot of challenges of living up to this incredible standard that maybe, you know, a legendary father might impose on a kid, you know, on a son. And that's where we came up with the song. I said, Jed, let's write about you, man. Let's write this, you know, kind of psychotherapy, man. Throw it, you know, spit it out, man. See what happens. And that's what that song's about.
And John, you mentioned a moment ago how you guys are bigger now than you were in the 80s. Is it different now than it was back then? And how do you guys avoid kind of going back through all of the same things that happened to you then?
It's completely different. We have much, you know, we're older, we're more mature. We have life experience behind us. You know, we do it for the love of the music now. You know, the success, and I've always felt this anyway. It's kind of my personal philosophy. I feel like you don't try to be successful. What you do is you try to be good. You try to learn your craft. You try to write the best songs you can, play your instrument, sing, you know, be good at what you do. And the success should be a byproduct of the hard work and the professionalism it shouldn't be the goal. I think a lot of the younger generation, especially with YouTube and with, you know, the digital world, you know, and with these shows, the proliferation of shows like American Idol and all that kind of stuff, it's almost like, you know, people, these kids can, they almost look at success as the goal. It shouldn't be the goal. It should be the byproduct of dedication and professionalism and hard work.
John, radio isn't the same as it used to be back in the 80s. Things are different now. It seems like there's not as much of an appetite for new music. Your thoughts? I mean, could we get to a point where we can get some new Hall & Oates music? Is that in the works?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I don't think we're not necessarily going for it, but it might happen. Daryl's wants to do something. He found a few people he likes to work with. I think what he'll do is he'll probably come up with some ideas and throw them at me, and then we'll bat them around and see where it goes. But I wouldn't say no to that. I would say there's a good possibility we may do something. But at the same time, you know, we have this really weird problem, really amazingly weird problem. We have too many hits. We go out on stage and people come to hear those songs. And so by the time we get done playing 13 or 14 number one records, we don't have a lot of time to play a lot of other stuff. So it's kind of an odd place to be. I mean, I'm very grateful for it. And it's, you know, and I'm sure a lot of musicians and artists would love to be in our position. But, you know, people pay, they come to a show, they expect to hear a certain song that, you know, they've loved for years. And I think it's our professional responsibility to play it. And we love those songs. It's not that we don't like them. You know, it's not like we're tired of them. They're good songs. But at the same time, it doesn't leave a lot of room for us to get into this 400 song catalog and deal with some of the deeper tracks or some of the other cool stuff that we've done. So it's kind of an unusual position to be in.
John, just a couple more before I let you go. And speaking of all those hits, you ever sit back and think to yourself or realize in your quiet moments the millions of lives that you've touched and had an impact on because of the, you know, of the wonderful music you've made? You've made an impact on so many of us.
Well, thank you. I don't dwell on it. I don't sit around and think about it, but it happens all the time when I, you know, meet people and, you know, people come up to me, whether it's musicians or fans or whatever. And, you know, you meet people and they talk about their favorite song or a moment in their life that maybe was impacted by the music or something that helped them get through an emotional period in their life. That's an amazing thing. And here again, it goes back to the songwriting. And, you know, the reason we're still around is because of those songs. The songs have stood the test of time. They've sustained, you know, and they seem to resonate with a younger generation too. It's really amazing to me. I mean, if somebody would have told me back in the 70s when we were starting that, you know, in the mid 2000s, you know, I'd be singing, performing, and the same songs that I was writing then are still sounding, you know, good and appealing to kids, you know, who could be my grandchildren. I mean, it's mind boggling. And, I don't take it for granted. I think it's a very, very unusual place to be in, a very, you know, not many people get that opportunity to have that. And, so I'm very appreciative and I want to keep going as long as my brain and fingers keep working.
So John, let us know, like, you know, what do you guys have on tap for 2020? What can we look forward to?
Well, about a 40-city tour, U.S. Last year we did two European tours and a South American tour, which were amazing. But this year we're staying in the United States, and we've got an amazing bill. We got KT Tunstall opening the show, and she's one of my favorites. She's amazing. And then the group Squeeze, who really haven't toured a lot recently. And they sound incredible. We did a show together in this past summer, and I hadn't heard them in a while, and they sound amazing. So it's going to be a great bill. We kick off the tour in Hershey, Pennsylvania, with kind of a warm-up show in late February, and then we open the tour at Madison Square Garden. And what a way to start a tour. I mean, can't beat that.
For our listeners who want to stay up to date with all the great things that both you and Daryl are doing and you're doing with your solo work, how can they follow you online and on social media?
Well, I've got an Instagram page, John Oates Official, and I post a lot of cool, funny stuff. And there's always, you know, hallandoates.com is probably the best place to tap into the Hall & Oates world. And, you know, we've got our social media thing going, and you can find us. We're there. We're floating around in the internet universe.
John, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to spend some time with me today. I hope I'll get the opportunity to catch up with you along the way. you're a lot of fun and fantastic. And go Titans for you. I'm rooting for the Titans on your behalf.
Watch out for Derrick Henry.
That's right. Absolutely right. That guy's a monster.
I can't wait.
Take care,
I can't
John.
Wait.
All the best to you and your
cool,
family.
Man. All right. Thanks, Chris. Bye.
Thanks, John. That's the great John Oates, HollandOates.com and John Oates Official on Instagram. What a huge honor to get to spend some time with John. I sure hope we get the opportunity to do it again sometime. And their U.S. tour, I hope that includes a stop here in Atlanta because I know I'll be online getting tickets for that show. Shout out to his agent, Tom Berger, for setting this up. Appreciate you very much, Tom. Folks, thank you all for tuning in and listening today. For more great interviews, be sure to check out Thursday Night Tailgate on great sites like Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. We're all over the net. Thank you so much, folks, again, for tuning in. Have a great day. She's gone.